Islam. You would see the light. You would
already
become
dark,
a brother.
I mean, I'm not going to stop eating Cuban sandwiches. I bake the bread. There's lard in the bread, Amr. Two different kinds of pork, and there's lard in the bread.
That sounds really good. Dude, it is always so funny to me how, like, pork is the one thing Muslims, like, even, like, you know, Muslims, I'm using the air quotes, where, like, they'll drink, they'll, like, fuck, whatever. Pork is the one line. Because, and my theory is that it's replaceable, right? Like, you know, you can't replace sex, you can't replace booze, really. But, you know, pork, you're like, whatever, I'll have lamb instead.
Turkey bacon will do in a pinch if you have to. It is not the same.
Look, I like certain types of pork. I like pork bacon when it's in like a burger or whatever. But I prefer turkey bacon. It's lighter. It's not as heavy on a...
I say if you're going turkey or if you're going bacon, you might as well go whole hog. You know, just eat whole that hog. Pig.
Badumpsh. I mean, Poles can't live without pigs. There's no way.
Yeah.
I think that's why there's no Polish Muslims.
Well, to be fair, the Poles are also not doing too well euro-wise, so, you know, yikes there.
It was just a tough group, you know?
Yeah,
copium, dude. Lewandowski wasn't playing either, so. You know, Connor, if you're out of the loop, we lost 3-1 to Austria yesterday, and we're out of the Euro Cup, basically. Yeah. We can't get out of groups.
I was at lunch yesterday with my partner, and we looked in the TV. We were at an Italian place owned by Italians, so they are watching the Euro Cup or whatever dumb shit y'all are talking about. And I saw that Austria and Poland were tied, and I looked at my partner and I asked her, I was like, hey, do you care about soccer at all? And she said, no. And I'm like, all right. And then we stopped looking at the TV. So my apologies and my condolences.
I don't apologize.
Well, I was when Austria first scored, I managed to get in that classic joke. I've never heard of an Austrian creating this much panic in Poland before.
Never. It's been a while.
Yeah.
Old habits die hard, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, I'm recording. If we want to get started.
Let's go.
Allahu Akbar.
Assalamu alaikum, listeners. This is a very special episode that we have been very excited about for Propagandos. It is Saturday, June 22nd. We've got a guest that Alec has been super hyped on. Please welcome Amr to the show. Hey, Amr, thanks for coming on. We appreciate it.
Wa alaikum assalam, brother.
Today we are all brothers of the book.
Thank you. I am here. Hopefully by the end of the episode, I will convince you of the light of Islam and you will pledge your allegiance.
I mean, you've almost got us. The movie that we watched for this week, as soon as I finished watching it, I did think, hey, can we go to Barnes & Noble? I want to see if they have the Quran.
I gotta say, this is propaganda. This is how you do propaganda. We've been watching a lot of crap, a couple good ones, but I was telling Connor before the record started, I think possibly the best indication that you've made a good propaganda piece is your film gets banned in the country that it's criticizing.
Yes. But, yeah, that I thought was hilarious.
So today we're going to be talking about two films. Amr, you want to pitch us? Give me the pitch that you gave me.
Yeah. So you know how people would say that James Cameron or maybe Ridley Scott are like the Napoleons of directing in terms of like mobilizing large numbers of resources and large numbers of people. No. You need to hear about this guy Mustafa Akkad. He's this director, this Arab director, who is famous for two. Well, he's famous as having produced Halloween, the movie series Halloween. But in terms of directing, he's a Syrian-American director who directed two big movies, both starring, ironically enough, Anthony Quinn and Irene Papas. Irene Papas, great dime, great looker, awesome. Oof. And the first movie he directed was The Message, also called Muhammad, Messenger of God, which is what it says on the tin. It's a biopic of the Prophet Muhammad that doesn't show the Prophet Muhammad, which is an interesting way to approach a biopic.
If somebody would have pitched me on the idea of making a movie about Muhammad, I would have immediately been like, well, you can't do that, right? That's not physically possible. And this film accomplishes it, and accomplishes it well.
Yeah, I was like, I rewatched it this week for this episode, and I was impressed at how, because I used to watch it a lot as a kid. I told you this before, Alec. Like, it is our version of like the Grinch Who Stole Christmas. Like, it shows up every Eid, they play it, but it holds up really well in terms of like the directing and the way it's produced. With the Prophet is essentially the camera. We can get into this later. And then the second movie he produced is, as a result of the production problems in the first movie, The Message, is Lion of the Desert, which is about Omar al-Mukhtar, the Libyan rebel who fought the Italians for 20 years in Italy, or in Libya, sorry.
A lot of shared imagery, a lot of shared themes between the two. Not surprising. Actually, The Message he produced, Mustafa Kod produces The Message before Halloween. So he was kind of basically a small-time understudy in Hollywood. He moves to the United States and gets into the Hollywood industry. Actually, an understudy of Sam Peckinpah for years, and then this enormous project, right? The creation, direction, and production of the film, The Message, eats up a lot of his time in the 70s until it finally comes to pass. And then his Western success actually comes after this, right? And he remains a producer and an executive producer on the Halloween franchise, returns to Libya, actually, as we'll talk about later, to produce and direct Lion of the Desert.
Yeah, his work in Hollywood is always producing. Like, it's besides The Message and Lion of the Desert, which are the two only two movies he directed, everything else he's a producer or executive producer. But like, that's his talent. Like, production, like in terms of what The Message really showed was this guy could really mobilize resources. And that's my pitch to Alec, was imagine a movie with two separate casts, an English-speaking cast and an Arabic-speaking cast. And they film the movie like in parallel. Like, they'll get the English cast in the fucking set in the morning. They'll do a set a scene, and then they'll be like, "All right, Arabic cast, come in." And the extra, they're all there, obviously.
Yes,
Which, by the way, salute to Brother Colonel Muammar Gaddafi for like pretty much press ganging the ex-president into doing this, which is awesome. We love you, Brother Colonel. We love you.
The resources devoted to these films are just insane. I mean, after you've seen The Message, Lion of the Desert is even more impressive, because
Absolutely.
you think that there's a lot of people and extras and crazy locations in The Message, and then you watch Lion of the Desert and you're like, wow, like this is 3 times, 4 times the level of direction and production as the previous movie.
Yes, I think in The Message, it's worth pointing out that for the most part, all the extras that are in The Message are, for lack of a better term, the masses. You know, they're just kind of following the main characters around. There's not much choreography of what their actions are supposed to be, as opposed to Lion of the Desert, where it is action scenes, action sequences. There are explosives. Things need to be timed and coordinated perfectly. Having produced, you know, some short films and some other things that are put on film and need perfect timing, I can only understand the tiniest fraction of like the amount of production needed to pull this movie off. Incredibly impressive, Lion of the Desert.
You're right, Connor, because like in The Message, the extra, they're just like, they're either like in a marketplace meant to make the marketplace look lively, or like ambling about in the Kaaba. The only 2 times the extras in The Message actually do something important is the two battle scenes, Badr and Uhud. Whereas in Lion of the Desert, it's battle after battle after battle after raid, and they're all like others, like a number of them on horseback and a number running around, and then the Italian extras or the guys who are supposed to play Italians are running around in like fucking vehicles and stuff. Like, the guy knows how to produce. It's awesome.
Breathtaking action scenes. I mean, if you these hold up as well as the big Hollywood movies of that era and beyond, right? Like, this is Spielberg level action sequences,
Absolutely.
if not even more impressive. But some of that comes from partnering up with Mr. Gaddafi, who might just have a couple tanks lying around that you can use.
A couple of tanks, and he can encourage locals to participate in the movie in a very, very convincing way.
So let's get into it. So, I mean, talking about the film, the locations are amazing. The sheer number of extras is like,
well, it wasn't supposed to be in Libya. That's the first thing that we're talking about the movie. If you want to start there, initially it was set to be in Morocco. So Aqad had started working on a script for The Message since 1967 and raising money for it. A bunch of donations came in from private individuals in the Gulf. He raised like some like five or 10 million US dollars initially, just without like just with a script. There's no like production, and then he gets the Moroccans to agree to host him in Morocco, and he builds a mini Mecca in the desert in Morocco, like an entire village, like supposed to represent Mecca in 600 AD in Morocco. And then the Saudis get wind of it, like the official Saudi government, and they reject it. They say this is blasphemy. That, you know, you're not supposed to portray. Well, the thing is, this is a time that's also very sensitive for the Saudis, because I remember mentioning this to people in terms of why the King Faisal was killed by his nephew in 1976, I believe. At that point, the Saudi Wahhabi establishment, the Islamic ultra-conservatives, the Salafists, were iconoclastic to the point that just the idea of radio and TV, whether it was haram or not, was being questioned. Like the idea of moving pictures, I'm not even talking about like portrayal of Muhammad or the portrayal of holy figures. I'm talking any human being portrayed on TV or the voice of a human being carried by the airwaves, is that blasphemy? That's something the Saudis were arguing about in the 60s, which is why when Aqad was doing a movie, and not only a movie, but a movie about the Prophet, the Saudis got really upset, and the Muslim World League, which was based in Riyadh or Mecca, I think it was Mecca, basically put out a publication saying, this is haram, you can't do this, it's illegal. And the Saudis squeezed the Moroccan government. They rang up their friends and said, you gotta kick this guy out. This guy has to fuck off.
And this was when the movie was already in production, right? I mean, these sets, presumably all of the stuff that happens in Mecca is from the first period of filming in Morocco.
Yes, partly. So there, the scenes in the end where they take Mecca, that's in Libya. But the early Meccan scenes are in Morocco, and they get kicked out. And this, like you said, this is in production. The cast is already there. Both sets of cast are already there. And they get told to fuck off. And then this is where the brother colonel comes in. The brother colonel.
Well, as I understand it, around this time, Muammar Gaddafi, he auditioned and was rejected for the part of Han Solo, which was being filmed in Tunisia right next door. And he thought, fuck y'all, I'm taking my ball and going home. I'm going to make my own movie. And that's when he decided, all right, let me get the message over here, right?
Am I getting that right? I can't be the star of a Hollywood production. I'll make my own movie.
I've heard those rumors. I don't know how accurate they are. I feel like it's one of those things that people say to try and make fun of Gaddafi. I mean, he is a lunatic, don't get me wrong. But this is also a period when Gaddafi was like, because Gaddafi changes ideologies about as much as you'd imagine. Like, he initially started as a pan-Arabist when he took over, and the message was his peak pan-Islamism. That's when he thought that he could, like, instead of making an Arab nation, he'll make a Muslim nation. Obviously, with him as its head, he, like, really went hard into, like, the idea of an Islamic, like, ummah, and that, you know, we have to all be Muslim and stuff. This is also when he was funding Islamic brigades in, like, neighboring Chad and Niger. So, you know, the message was a great way for him to show himself as a Muslim leader, which, you know, contrasts nicely when he produces Lion of the Desert, which Omar al-Mukhtar was a religious figure as well. He was a leader of the Senussi order. But at that point, Gaddafi had made it clear to Aqad to like tone down the religion. Like, yeah, he could be a teacher and teach the Quran, but tone down the Senussi Sufism. We're back to being... That was his pan-African phase. That's when he went to pure pan-Africanism.
That's interesting, because Lion of the Desert doesn't... I mean, it has the Quran as a prop, literally.
Yes,
right?
Where with the wooden...
Omar Mukhtar in the non-battle scenes basically is constantly either holding or reading the Quran.
Yeah.
But the religious themes are quite a bit toned down as opposed to reading the biography of Mukhtar, right?
Yeah, I can only think of one scene.
Because when Gaddafi took over Libya, he overthrew a Libyan king, and the Libyan king was the figurehead for the Senussi order. The Senussi order, or a Sufi order that originated in Libya. And the king was a descendant of the original Senussi, the original Muhammad ibn Senussi. So Gaddafi, it was very awkward for Gaddafi because on the one hand, when he took over, he really went down hard on the Senussi scholars and religious communities. But he also wanted to portray himself because during his pan-Islamic phase, you'd imagine he would go really hard into the Senussism, but he couldn't because he took over directly from them.
So
he was like, okay, we'll do the message, the prophet. That's safe. That's a safe bet. Everyone likes the prophet, you know? And then when he goes to the Lion of the Desert, he focuses a lot on the anti-colonial struggle with the Italians. So, like, he tones down the Islam and goes hard on, like, we're all African against, you know, the European, the wretched European. But Lion of the Desert is the direct, like, that was a negotiation with Akkad. When he got kicked out of Morocco, Gaddafi was like, I'll give you a set. I'll give you all the extras you want. I'll give you money, whatever. In return, when you finish this movie, the next movie you need to make is Lion of the Desert about Omar Mukhtar. Like, he didn't call it Lion of the Desert. He said, you have to make a movie about Omar Mukhtar.
That still happens in Hollywood today. You know, you do one for you, you do one for them. You have to do the big Lion of the Desert so you can get your cute little indie flick about Muhammad.
unlike you know, pedophile Hollywood producers who are like, you gotta make a big movie for us, etc. and so on, the brother Colonel, like, he went all out. He's like, you know, you gotta get me a big film about Omar Mukhtar. And also, it was a make work program for Anthony Quinn and Irene Papas, who I don't believe, like they were out of Hollywood at that point. I think, like, they were,
I mean,
Anthony Quinn especially.
Anthony Quinn's career has been, I mean, he's, I would almost say, what do you think, Albert? Is Anthony Quinn almost Arab passing? I mean, he's darker skinned than all of the fucking English actors that they have in both of these movies. But
he's darker skinned, and the beard does a lot for him. Like, when he grows the beard, it does a lot for him. He looks like half my uncle's.
He's Mexican, isn't he?
He was kind of, yeah, and he was typecast, right, as a swarthy Mexican desperado in a number of movies. White today is not necessarily white for Hollywood in the 50s and 60s, right? They mean really white. They mean really, really white. So, you know, what's kind of unsurprising, maybe, given that context, is that Anthony Quinn kind of, in his middle age and elder years, kind of runs out of those kinds of typecast roles that he could be befitted to. And out of nowhere, seemingly, comes this opportunity that cements him possibly in film legend, right? At least.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not featured critically in the Arabic version of The Message, which is the version,
the one
of
the
film,
that Arabs will watch. Yeah.
But if white boys like me find out about it, I'm down for some Anthony Quinn. It'll get me to watch the film.
Yeah. I mean, Anthony Quinn is fascinating because, yeah, like you said, like, he was typecast as a classic, like, Mexican, you know, swarthy Mexican fella in all of these movies. But in both The Message and Lion in the Desert, he's actually, I don't want to say typecast because they're both biopics about historical figures, but he plays them with the same note. He plays them with the same, like, you know, the guy who is both wise and also, like, very rugged, hunts a lot, you know, in the desert, a man of the desert, if you will, you know.
I did want to point out before we get too deep into the message that, Alec, you mentioned that there are two different versions of this film. There's one shot in English with Anthony Quinn as Hamza, and there's one shot in Arabic with Abdullah Gaith as Hamza. I watched the Arabic version. I did not get to see Anthony Quinn as Hamza.
I watched the English version, and then I kind of scrubbed through the Arabic version just to see what maybe some of the differences were. I mean, it truly is like a shot-for-shot remake. The Arabic version's a little bit longer.
Yeah, it's about 30 minutes longer. And for those listening, this is not a dub. This is, all right, we shot a scene with the Arab actors. Everyone get offset. Let's bring the English actors on and reshoot that entire scene. Truly making this production even more impressive.
Right? And this is what I keep telling people. It's not a dub. It's not a sub. This isn't like they didn't get some studio in fucking Japan to dub this or whatever. No. This is like he had like two brigades and he was moving them around like the Battle of fucking Austerlitz over here.
It's awesome. I mean, like Amr said, it's very funny when you compare the two versions. By the way, you can watch all of these films. I think they're basically all on YouTube.
All three.
Both versions of The Message and Line of the Desert. The fucking Arabic version of The Message is in widescreen and has better quality. So If you don't want to see Anthony Quinn, if you want to watch a better looking film, I think on YouTube, just go for the Arabic version. But it's very funny when the background extras do not change. So you switch between the two versions of, you know, at one point they're in the Abyssinian court and it's literally the same guys in the same positions in the background. And then the king, the Muslim refugees basically, and the Abyssinian king have changed.
It's awesome. It's so cool. Like I would have loved to have been an extra on either of those movies. It would have been so sick. Just hanging out and being like, all right, time to do the Arabic, mumbles in Arabic. Time to do the English, mumbles in English.
So Amr, if you're familiar with it, is the difference between the runtime just because old Arabic takes so long to say? I mean, are we missing big scenes or?
Not really. There are a couple of actual scenes that are missing, mostly just conversations between characters that are meant to be more like, you know, kind of characterize certain people more. But yes, Arabic is also very, the Arabic used in the message is the Arabic that scholars think was spoken in 600 AD Arabia, or the closest we can get based on like the Quran and other scripts.
It's like Quranic Arabic, right?
Yeah, which is very, very awkward because no one actually speaks it regularly. Like you see it in like newscasts, like official documents, newscasts, it's still used. So like if you get a letter from the government, they will write it in official Arabic. Or if you watch the news or certain speeches by certain figures will use classical Arabic. The funny thing for me is like if you watch speeches, for example, by Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, he'll do the official speech in official Arabic, the Quranic Arabic, but you could tell when he gets really angry or really emotional, he'll slip into Lebanese Arabic. Like you'll see a slip, you'll see a change. You can catch it if you speak Arabic.
But it's like, usually intelligible, right? I mean, I've heard it compared basically to like the King James Bible. Is that?
Yeah, or to Shakespearean English would be another way. Like if you imagine like speaking in Shakespearean English in your day to day, like in the coffee shop or whatever. But like it is unlike, say, Europe, where because of the Reformation and the arguments over like, you know, making the Bible in vernacular and stuff like that. If it, like, you know, Latin died out because no one really needed to learn it because you could just read the Bible in German or whatever. Everyone still sort of kind of needs to learn official Arabic because the government still use it and because the Quran is in Arabic. That's the other important thing. Now, a lot of non-Arab Muslims don't know Arabic, so they read translations of the Quran. But if you're Arab Muslim, you'll still read the official Arabic Quran because they can't make a dialect of Arabic of the Quran because that's considered heresy. So like the Quran in Arabic is still like, it's as if you're learning all of Shakespearean English just to read Shakespeare.
Yeah,
but then you can keep that in your head whenever if someone speaks it or whatever. Honestly, I was impressed with the Arabic actors. Like they sold it well. Like it didn't feel like a lot of other shows and movies I've watched in Arabic time pieces. It can be very clunky, but in this movie they kind of did pretty well. I like the Arabic Hamza actor was really good in it.
That's incredible. I don't think a feat like this has been accomplished in Hollywood, with the exception of like the new Shogun series. I know it's filmed in like old Japanese, and then Passion of the Christ was filmed in Aramaic, which Amr, we'll have to have you back on sometime so we can try and get you to convert.
Revert.
Honestly, the only way you can get me to convert is Baldwin from Kingdom of Heaven. That's the closest I've ever come to believing in Christianity.
That one's on our list. So
talking about this episode has produced so many other paths of films to talk about with regard to Islam and Christianity. And
this movie, Kingdom of Heaven, and Dune are part of what I call the Islamic Extended Universe, the IEU.
All right, you are our ICU guest from here on out.
Yeah. By the way, watching Southern white people scream Lisan al-Gaib after leaving Dune 2 was an impressive feat of propaganda. They do not know what language they speak.
Isn't Mahdi the only actual Arabic word that's in Dune? Is everything
also an Arabic phrase? Lisan al-Gaib just means the voice of absence. Okay. But it can roughly translate to like what they say, the voice from the outer space or whatever. The Mahdi is actually like the Imam Mahdi, like the guy who will lead us to salvation. Which honestly, I keep thinking, as an aside, we'll get back to the message in a second, but as an aside, Frank Herbert wrote Dune, the first Dune, in 1965, which leads me to believe he went to the local library with enough cocaine in him to kill a small elephant and read the Quran over and over again. And like, he was like, all right, we're going to get this baby. Let's go.
Just jotting down notes. You know, that library book was unreturnable by the time he was done with it. Yeah, just powder falling out of it.
Frank Herbert has done more to sell Islam to the West than anyone, with the exception of Akkad, obviously.
By the way, avoiding the word jihad in Dune was a particular choice, because I think that would have broken the illusion for a lot of, especially American viewers.
I was watching it in the theater and I was fuming. I just kept tapping my friend being like, say it, jihad.
But I think that would have broken the mirror. It would have cracked.
The other thing they didn't do, which they intentionally mistranslated in Dune, is that in the books, the phrase "Long live the fighters," it comes from the Algerian phrase, which was used during the Algerian War of Independence, "Yahya Shuhada," which means "Long live the martyrs." Yeah, but in the movie, they brought the guy who did Dothraki in Game of Thrones to make like a fictional language, like a fucking gibberish, to avoid saying "Long live the martyrs," because, you know, after October 7th, saying "Long Yahya Shuhada" would be very.
It would have gone over the heads of Americans, I promise. Yes. Right? Lisan al
Ghaib. I would have stood up in a theater and been like, "Yahya Shuhada!" And then get arrested. Zoomers,
we're going to have 60 more years of Lisan al Ghaib because of that generation. It's going to be a meme for them like long after I'm dead.
Do you think for a certain type of Groiper or based Zoomer or whatever they call themselves, if Donald Trump is arrested, Barron will be their Paul Atreides? He will disappear for a bit and then come back leading like just a jihad, essentially.
I've made that joke on Twitter. I mean, yeah, that, or I mean, Connor and I have been joking about if Donald Trump runs into a bunch of Nation of Islam guys in prison and converts, that would be
he's gonna convert.
Awesome.
I found the light of Muhammad upon him.
I've heard the message. There's one guy, Allah. You're gonna hear it.
Muhammad makes great deals, great merchant. He makes great deals.
Abu Sufyan, he didn't want him in Mecca, he threw him out. But guess what? They came back.
By the way, the actor who plays Abu Sufyan in the English version of The Message, Michael Ansara, is also Syrian, which again, when he was in Hollywood, I believe his most famous role was Commander Kang in Star Trek. Yeah, so I know him as Commander Kang. I know he was in a bunch of other things, but he's usually typecast as, like, I don't want to say a villain, but like sort of villain adjacent.
He's a little evil looking with those. Yeah. They do a lot of eyeshadow, by the way, in The Message, which
yes.
Is that a particular kind of like Arabic media thing where like the evil character, like Jafar, right? He's got feminine
media
lashes.
It's very Oriental. Like, this is Edward Said Orientalism 101. It's like in Arabia at the time, everyone wore those eyeshadows because it was a way to reflect the sun away from your eyes. But in Hollywood, it's seen as like a sign of a villain. Another thing you might have noticed in The Message is, when people convert to Islam during the movie, they go from wearing the most ostentatious colored clothing to just white robes, which I was like, again, like, that's something I found interesting rewatching it now. Like, it really goes hard on austerity, like the austerity of Muslims versus the decadence of the Meccan polytheist. One scene that stuck out with me and I died laughing when I rewatched it is the night before the first battle, the night before the Battle of Badr, when the Meccans are in their camp and there's music and the girls are dancing and they bring in this massive tray of like lamb and rice and they all have goblets in their hand and they're drinking wine. And just to like hammer home, these are like decadent, awful, like, you know, good times create weak people, etc. Like fucking cycle. The one guy tries to grab the dancer girl, slips, falls, and then all of his friends are just like laughing at him. And I'm like, Akkad, you genius. Hell yes.
just an overview for the audience. Like Alex said, these movies are all available on YouTube. And The Message is the story of the birth of Islam. Muhammad is not shown in this movie. In fact, the opening has some subtitles in it that says, like, hey, look, we're not going to show his person. You're not going to hear his voice. You're not going to see his shadow. And so anytime Muhammad...
And by the way, we cleared this with a bunch of imams in Egypt. So don't call us.
And
The Saudis said it was forbidden, but the Azhar University, which is considered one of the highest institutes of Islamic scholarship, approved, as well as some Shia authorities in Lebanon we're supposed to also approve. I mentioned the Shia authorities because, to your point, Connor, it's not just Muhammad who's not shown. They take care to avoid all of the four caliphs that came after Muhammad, who are considered very important in Islamic history. Abu Bakr, Umar, Uthman, and Ali. Ali is the Prophet's cousin, but he's younger than him by 20 years and ends up marrying the Prophet's daughter. He's considered the second holiest figure in Shia Islam. Abu Bakr is the Prophet's friend, companion, and the first caliph, and then Umar and Uthman are the other two caliphs between Abu Bakr and Ali. And because of all the fucking sensitive subjects there, especially the succession, like because the succession was a succession crisis, Akkad avoids all of them. You don't see any of them, which is why Anthony Quinn is Hamza, because Hamza becomes the closest thing we can get to. It's Anthony Quinn as Hamza and what's his name? The guy who plays Damian Thomas. He plays Zayd ibn Haritha, who's the Prophet's adopted son. Those two are the closest we get to the Prophet in terms of like figures who are around during important historical moments.
Whenever Muhammad enters the scene, he is not shown on camera, but everyone on set looks directly at the camera. Yeah. And it is a very clever way of getting you to sense that Muhammad is in the room. You can feel his presence. You don't see him. But as a film technique, it made me question, am I supposed to feel like I am Muhammad? Is this like, yeah. At first I was like, is this sacrilegious? Am I crazy for even thinking I'm supposed to feel like I'm the Prophet? Like, what the hell is going on here?
I mean, I guess it just comes down to where else are you going to put the camera, right? Like, yeah. He can't be behind everybody and then like constant. There's a couple scenes where he's just like in a crowd and you can't see him because he's covered up by other people's bodies, essentially.
Yes.
And then in all the scenes where he's the center of the scene, you see it basically through his eyes, which is a kind of bizarre effect.
No voice. So like you'll have people talk at the camera, and then when he's supposed to respond, it'll be silence. And then the people he's talking to will repeat what he said in a sort of quizzical way.
It was so funny anytime, I don't know the name of the character, but he just like come out from the room. He's like, I just talked to Muhammad. Here's what he had to say.
Amar.
Yeah.
Amar keeps bursting in the room.
Ali ibn Abi Talib, the Prophet's uncle. Ali's father, ironically enough, but yes.
Now, Amr, to your point, there were some people that were not shown in the film. Alec and I have been talking about this guy named Ali. Why was Ali not shown in the film? Can you give us some context?
So the closest you get to Ali is the scene during the Battle of Badr when they do the duels, and you see that curved sword with two points.
Yeah.
That's Ali's famous sword. It's called Dhul-Fiqar.
That is a trope in itself.
Yes.
Oh, okay, so that's recognizable to Muslims as that's
yes, Ali's yes,
story.
Yes.
Okay.
That's Ali's faith. If you want to know if someone is Shi'i or not, like, I mean, it's not a hard rule, but like, chances are they'll either have a necklace with that sword or a tattoo of that sword. That sword is considered like Ali's sword. Is because like it's the double. Like, I don't know how to describe it. It's like two points coming out of the sword.
It's like a saber, but ending in two points instead of one. Kind of split.
Yes.
Like a serpent.
It looks like
a
forked tongue.
I have seen that symbol and I didn't know what it was. My God.
It's Ali's sword, and Shia people will have like necklaces of it, tattoos of it. It's like a thing. That's the closest you get to seeing Ali. Like, you just see the sword, you don't even see his hand or anything. And the reason is, in Shi'i Islam, Ali is the first imam after Muhammad, and he's an imam is a holy figure for Shi'ism. Like, it's the Ahlul Bayt, the family of the Prophet, are seen as holy as the Prophet himself. And then there's also like the movie obviously really avoids this because it doesn't want to touch like very controversial stuff, but the succession crisis basically is because when Muhammad dies, there's a group of people that think Ali should have succeeded him because A, he's the Prophet's cousin, B, he married the Prophet's daughter, and C, there are credible claims that the Prophet had designated him as a successor. Whether that's spiritual or also political, that's where the argument starts. Whereas Abu Bakr, who's who becomes the first successor, the caliph, he ends up becoming the caliph because he maneuvers politically to gain the allegiance of various tribes in Medina the Shia say, while Muhammad's body was still warm, like it didn't even wait for it to go cold before moving to rob Ali of his birthright. That's the sort of accusation. He was just more politically savvy and you know, got his the allegiance and then became caliph. The movie avoids all of that. It ends when Muhammad dies. And it doesn't even show any scenes where Muhammad might designate anyone as his successor. It just, you know, Muhammad dies and that's Islam is born. That's it. But yeah, to avoid all of that, all four caliphs are not shown.
So if you watch these movies on YouTube, probably about the first 20 minutes or so of the film, it's pretty jarring that Muhammad's not in it, right? You almost keep waiting for him to walk out on screen.
Yeah.
And then probably about 20 minutes in, for me, that just broke. And you kind of accept that he's not in the film. Yeah. He's not shown. Yeah. At the Battle of Badr, Ali being out of frame, you're like, okay, wait, who's that guy? Why is he not in it? Right. I know who Ali is. I kind of understand, I guess, at some level, but it's also striking. But then the rest of the film, it actually almost feels natural. It you stop kind of suspending your disbelief about that thing.
I texted Alec as a joke. This should have been called Samuel Bakir Waiting for Gomo.
Yeah.
Because Muhammad never shows up.
I mean, it's a real accomplishment. It's
the one scene where it was a bit jarring was later on after the Meccans break the truce and Abu Sufyan comes to Medina to renegotiate the truce. And Muhammad is like turning away from him and you can see the camera turning left and right. And Abu Sufyan like running to try and be like, no, look at me. And he's like, it's so fucking awesome. It's so cool.
That was really good.
Yeah, that scene where everybody stares at the camera, right? Everybody breaks the fourth wall.
It's like fucking 200 people are in this mosque. They're all staring at the camera. Abu Sufyan is running left to right and right to left. And the camera is meant to show Muhammad shaking his head to look away. And you, as the audience members, feel like you're shaking your head to look away from the screen. But you're not because you're looking at the screen. And it just feels very much like, you know, like a child turning his head not to look at you.
Yeah. Zoomers, take note. This is what POV means on TikTok. Not anything. This is what POV, you have offended the Prophet Muhammad and he will not accept your apology.
So let's talk about the elephant in the room. Let's talk about DEI in Islam and DEI in this Quranic story. I did not know who Bilal was. I'm not going to lie. So when they had, I was like, this is Muhammad's hanging out with a black guy? I thought they were Arabs. So.
Okay, so first of all, historically, there's been a lot of there was a lot of trade and a lot of slave raiding between both Arabia and Abyssinia, or like the eastern coast of Africa. There have been mercantile relationships, but Bilal is very interesting. Within the movie, he's very interesting because you know who wanted to play Bilal in that movie? No. Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali petitioned Akkad to play in that movie. He reached out to be like, I want to play Bilal in this movie you're making about Muhammad. Again, I'm telling you, this production story of this movie is as fascinating as the movie itself. But apparently both Akkad and the actor who ends up playing Bilal, Johnny Secco, implied that Muhammad Ali is too buff and too fit to convincingly play a slave, which kind of makes sense, but kind of doesn't, because you also imagine slaves would be very fit because they're constantly working. But I think they wanted Bilal to look very like Muhammad Ali carries himself with a certain level of like he's very like strong, very powerful, and they want Bilal to be more contrite, more humble to do, because again, a lot of this movie is hammering home how much of the underdogs Muslims were, like how they're like the rebels from Star Wars. Essentially, they need to be in rags, they need to look weak so that the victory can look a lot better in the end. But overall, Bilal in Islamic history is very interesting because in modern era, like now, Bilal is often thrown about by Muslims to show that Islam isn't racist, because who he was a slave. we know for a fact. Yeah.
Literally.
Well, but the other thing, we don't know much about him in reality. It's just a lot of mythological backtracking, like a lot of projection from modern era, like a lot of post, like, you know, American discourse on chattel slavery is thrown back in time to either defend or accuse Islam of being racist. It's either like, you know, racist calling, saying, oh, actually Islamic slavery was worse than chattel slavery, or Muslims defending that accusation by saying, well, Muhammad freed Bilal, which is the worst way you could defend yourself against accusation, as far as I'm concerned.
They're basically saying, like, we don't know anything about his personality, but we know he was black.
No, that's the thing. We don't know he was black. That's the thing. That was so funny about the movie for me, and funny whenever I talk to Muslims about this. There's this idea in modern Islam that Bilal was black. He might be. We don't know for sure. We know that he was a slave, but there were a lot of Arab slaves as well, because I remember mentioning this to Alec before, like, on freedom, like, I don't like using the word slavery for these systems, because slavery often brings to mind chattel slavery, the Atlantic slave trade, you know, which is a very specific form of slavery. Whereas Arab slavery in pre-Islamic Arabia and then into Islamic Arabia was a lot more a mix of Roman slavery, of raiding, of other forms of, like, unfreedom, where prisoners of war are expected to provide a certain amount of labor to reattain their freedom, or to be liberated by their owner through, like, certain, like, you know, whether it's Eid or, like, certain holy days or whatever. Either way, there's different rules. But all we know is that Bilal was a slave. He could be black. We don't know. He could be from Abyssinia. And he's known in modern Islam because he converted to Islam, and his owner, Umayyah, is like this, like, he's portrayed as, like, the most evil of all, well, one of the most evil of all of the villains in this movie. He's basically like, you're telling me in Islam a slave is equal to his master, so I am equal to Bilal? Yeah.
He throws, is it Ammar? He throws
Ammar. Yeah, Ammar. Yeah, Ammar is Ammar's parents are the first two martyrs in Islam. But that's that. Yeah,
he orders Bilal to whip him, and then Bilal refuses. Right, and then actually, in one of the only scenes I believe that's removed from both YouTube versions, Bilal is presumably whipped. Right,
tortured.
It's in the Arabic version. It's in the Arabic version.
Yeah, it's removed from the English version. I noticed that. He's not whipped. He is tortured. They put a bunch of rocks on him in the desert heat. Like, they put him outside, they splay him, they tie him up, and they put a bunch of rocks on him. And then the seminal scene that every Muslim child is taught about Islamic history is that Muhammad sends his representatives to buy Bilal's freedom for converting. So they essentially pay over the odds to get him to stop being tortured. But in a similar sequence, Ammar, the guy you mentioned who was thrown to the ground, his parents are also captured. Ammar is poor, which is why he doesn't have the protection of other tribes people who were converting to Islam at the time. So his parents were considered fair game to capture and torture. His mom is raped and killed, and his dad is killed. And they become the first martyrs in Islam. There's a lot of lore there.
I mean, Ammar...
Yeah, Bilal...
Bilal is one of the most compelling characters in the film. You fall in love with Bilal, and when he's elevated to the first muezzin, am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah, he becomes a muezzin, who is
the first caller to prayer. It's such a pure moment, right?
That
you're like,
scene is incredible. I watch a lot of, like, music biopics, and that was, like, the closest you could get to it, because he gets up there and he's like, call everyone to prayer, and he's just, like, shouting, like, God is the greatest, come on out.
Connor, it's the build up to it where they're like, how do we call people to prayer? And they're like, well, the Christians use bells. Do we want to use bells? And they're like, no, well, not really. And they're like, the Jews use a horn. Should we use a horn? And it's like, no. And then, like, drums. Drums are too warlike. And then, like, what about the human voice?
Human voice, yeah.
Yeah, it was so sick.
And so he's just shouting and shouting. And then he decides to put a little stank on it and sing. And it is awesome. And it's, like, really beautiful.
It's so cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
He gets his redemption there, and then afterwards, when he fights, he finds his former master in the battlefield and kills him.
On sight.
Yeah, like, Maya!
I did expect a forgiveness scene in the middle of battle, and I'm like,
no,
yeah, no, straight up murdered him. I'm like, all right, that's pretty cool.
The movie does a lot to emphasize that forgiveness is good. God is merciful. God does not act with aggression. But if you are persecuting the Muslims, you will be killed. You know,
I mean, you got to defend your stuff, right?
Yeah.
By the way, something repeated in Lion of the Desert, right? Which is
yes.
He tries some asshole Italian tries to tell him what's in the book.
Yeah.
So a question I did have is that the Islam that is portrayed within this film is very progressive and it seems very liberal. They even say that, you know, women are equal with men. They have the same rights, but there are very few women in the film, and the ones who are like villains. And I wanted to know, earlier in the discussion, you said that, you know, Gaddafi told him, hey, turn to Islam down a little bit. Is this portrayal of Islam, was that like how it was seen at the time? Was that the Islam of the region? Is this accurate?
Okay, that's a complicated question. First of all, Connor, you missed my favorite part of that scene where he talks about equality. That, like, the guy who used to run Medina before Muhammad fled there, Salul, he's like also a villain. He comes to the Meccans to like tell them what's going on, but, you know, sort of spy. And he's like, look, he's giving the women rights. And they're like, oh, what next? The animals? And he's like, the lunatic has. He's given camels rights. You're not supposed to overload them. I fucking love that. I was like, king, yes, Akka, let's go. Which is actually fairly accurate. Like, Muhammad did preach things like you're not supposed to abuse any beasts of burden. You're supposed to like give them water and food and not overload them. So the question of women is very complicated. The main woman character, because also speaking of characters they don't show because of political and religious sensitivities, okay. The Prophet's first wife, Khadija, is also not shown.
Gotcha.
Which makes the main woman character is the villain, who's played by Irene Papas, Hind bint Utba, who's the wife of Abu Sufyan. She plays that character really well. I love how psychotic she is. It is Islamic lore that in the Battle of Uhud, when Hamza is killed, spoilers, she cuts out his liver and eats it. In terms of equality and stuff, that scene when they talk about equal rights for women, he does a really clever bait and switch, Akkad, that I think misses what Islam really meant to the region. They talk about equality, but before they talk about equality, I don't know if either of you noticed, I think it was Abu Sufyan who says, he's reading the fucking like the laws that Muhammad had enacted, and he's like, all Muslims are like kin to one another. Every Muslim is in one tribe. And then Abu Sufyan casually mentioned, oh, he'll have to get over the nature of the tribe to apply that. But that's the most important thing of Islam. What Islam really did to Arabia was override tribal loyalties and make it that all Muslims are one tribe. Blood feuds are no longer between tribes, but between Muslims and non-Muslims. And if any other Muslim is harmed, your duty as a Muslim is to protect that Muslim, even if he's from a different kin or family. That was the important thing. But he does this bait and switch where he just dismisses that and then goes into like rights of like the camels and the women and stuff. That said, the way it's portrayed, it's, you know, he does really ham up the equality a lot. He says things like women are allowed to choose their husband, which is true in a legal sense, but obviously that wasn't really applied equally everywhere, even after Islam. The one big thing that Islam did was that pre-Islam, there was a tradition in that part of Arabia where if a man had too many daughters, he'd bury them alive. Yeah. In the desert, because you don't want to have too many daughters.
Femicide.
Femicide.
Which is a big deal in like the first hour of the movie, perhaps.
Yes.
Like, one of the big
Amar's mother mentions that she was supposed to, Sumayya, she was supposed to have been a femicide, but her dad just couldn't do it after he killed two of her older sisters. But that was a big deal in the movie because it's considered a big deal in Islamic world. That's one of the things Islam expressly forbade was femicide. And there's verses in the Quran where, like, you know, it's said in like the end of days, these infants, their souls will come up and ask, what crime have I done to warrant this punishment? And it's quite moving in Arabic, and the poetry is quite heavy. But it shows that Muhammad, when he was preaching, was a radical millenarian, but also like an expressly political figure. He was going against the grain of Arabia in a way that he knew would alienate him from very powerful people. Things like, you know, inheritance was another big one that they make fun of in the movie. Like, the villains are like, oh, he's saying the woman can inherit. Pre-Islamic Arabia, women didn't have inheritance rights at all. They were kind of like Greek women in that sense. Whereas, again, Islam is not as equal as you think it is, because women inherit less than men. So like, if you have one son and one daughter, the split is 2/3 to 1/3. So a daughter inherits 1/3, the son inherits 2/3. This is in the Quran too.
Comparatively, is still progressive by
it is, you know, progressive, and the argument made by Muslims is that 2/3 to 1/3, because the son needs that inheritance to take care of his wife, whereas the daughter is expected to get married, and then her husband would take care of her through the dowry in particular. And that's the other thing, like rights over dowries, rights over divorce. A woman is allowed to initiate divorce. A woman can initiate divorce for any reason, including sexual dissatisfaction, by the way, which I'm serious. It's so awesome. Both parties can initiate divorce for any reason. But yeah, it's meant to show that it's a big leap forward from pre-Islamic Arabia, which in Arabic is called the Age of Jahiliyyah, which is the age of ignorance. I don't think that's fair. I mean, it is Islamic propaganda to look at the pre-Islamic era as just pure ignorance. But the Mecca in particular was very brutal at that time for those who were not part of the mercantile elite. It did introduce a lot of rights. It codified laws, because before then, laws were a lot more tribal, right? Like, a lot of laws were basically like blood feuds and an eye for an eye, whereas these rights that were given universally to all Muslims to follow, which helped create a universalist code that everyone can then understand their expectations and obligations in a way that tribal society didn't really have, because it was always like, oh, if we start this, it'll be a feud or whatever, you know? I hope that answered the question. I just went on
a tangent there. It does. Yeah. Yeah. I wasn't trying to gotcha or anything, but I just noticed it's like, there aren't a lot of women in this film, and they made a point of it to say that, like, women are equals.
So in every, like, I'm Polish, right, obviously, and if you were to watch some Polish films that are made for Poles, there's going to be some stuff that you're just missing context for that, like, goes over your head. Even watching the English version of this, or the Arabic version with subtitles, are there themes that aren't coming across in translation, right? I know, like, the Ali, like, the sword, right, being an indicator of Ali is kind of maybe one of those. Are there other things that come to mind?
The Bilal, the entire Bilal story is a big, like, it's like, you know, shout out to Islamic lore. It's meant to make us feel good about Islam, especially like the way we were taught about it as kids. The entire scene when Hamza comes from hunting and sees that Muhammad is being accosted around the Kaaba and converts right there and then, that's very like, that is like, you know, preaching to the choir. That's like pure crowd bait for Muslims, because that's like a seminal piece of lore for Muslims. Is like, Hamza was out hunting, the Prophet was being accosted by the Meccan, you know, heathens or whatever, and he comes back, and Hamza is always known as like a very good warrior, but also like a drinker, a dicer, like a playboy, essentially. So they don't really portray in this
cool
fucking movie.
Guy.
Yeah, really fucking, he was like the Hunter S.
Your
Thompson
cool
of like the fucking Mecca. Yeah, he would have worn a leather jacket and rode a bike, like a motorbike, if he was modern times. Which, by the way, If I was a billionaire, I would want to redo the message, but the way, you know, Romeo plus Juliet was made, where it was like modernized. Yeah, I would do that, and it would be like biker gangs or shit. It would be so sick. He says one of the coolest lines I've heard in the English version, at least the Anthony Quinn one, where he goes, "He is the bravest man in the desert when he faces unarmed men." And he whips Abu Jahl with his bow, like he like slaps him around a bit. But that was a big, like, for Muslims, that was like just hooting and hollering. Like, we're like, we want the slop. We want more. We just want slop.
I got to say, about Abu Jahl, is Abu Jahl perhaps the most hated man in history?
Two. There's Abu Lahab and Abu Jahl. Abu Lahab is the Prophet's other uncle, who's like the villain uncle.
Okay.
And Abu Lahab means father of fire. And there's a chapter in the Quran dedicated entirely to him. It's a very short chapter, but it's basically like he's going to burn in hell. He's like, you know, he's going to suffer for eternity for this. And Abu Jahl means father of ignorance, because his pre-Islamic name was Abu al-Ma'rifah, which is father of knowledge. So Muhammad, in classic Donald Trump style, like, you know, he's a father of ignorance.
Knowledge, more like ignorance, folks. Am I right?
Yeah. But which is funny, because Ikramah, Abu Jahl's son, becomes one of the most important Muslim lieutenants later on. But Abu Jahl is one of the two most hated people in Islam universally. Now, if you ask Shia and Sunni, there's like, Each sect would hate people of the other sect for whatever reason. But in terms of universal Islam, Abu Jahl and Abu Lahab are the two ones who are like pure villains, pure, like, there's no redemption there.
Because I was even counting on my fingers, like, who would be comparable? I mean, there might be somebody in Chinese history that I'm not aware of, or you know, Indian history, perhaps, a Hindu history. But Judas Iscariot is the only person that comes to mind as even like comparable. You fucked
I don't know
around.
If Judas or Pontius Pilate would be more, you know, hated.
Ah, but Pontius Pilate offered Barabbas.
he does end up regretting it, at least, right? Or like the context of what he's done, right, comes into frame, at least.
There's a certain wing of anti-Semitism within evangelical Christianity that is like, Pontius Pilate was just following orders.
For real. Unironically, yeah.
Yeah.
To be fair, Pontius, from the way you guys explain it to me, it, like, I imagine him as a very Abu Sufyan figure, as like someone who opposed the Prophet but then regretted his opposition in various ways. So, whereas, yeah, Judas maybe, I suppose.
Abu Sufyan is, as I understand it, kind of redeemed in Islamic lore.
He converts. After the conquest of Mecca, he converts and becomes one of the fighters who take over Syria. He uses his Syria mercantile connections during the Arab expansion into Syria, and he becomes the father of the Caliph Muawiyah, who comes after Ali. And that's where the real Sunni Shia split really happens, because Muawiyah, Abu Sufyan's son, becomes the engineer for the first fitna, which is the first like real civil war. And then Muawiyah's son, Abu Sufyan's grandson, Yazid, is responsible for Karbala, which is where Ali's son Hussein is killed and where all of Shia lore sort of stems from. So yeah, he's redeemed in the sense that he becomes Muslim and fights for Islam, but then he's unredeemed in terms of sectarian thought, where Sunnis kind of venerate him and Shia hate him, because he brought about the line that would fight Ali's line for the next like 300 years.
Maybe we should talk about it real quick. I mean, one of the most important characters depicted is Khalid.
For the
future of the Arab conquests, basically, right? He's the fucking man. He first fights and oppresses the early Ummah, and then their piety and...
He inflicts on the Muslims their only defeat in the battlefield in Uhud, using the classic cavalry maneuver of, like, you know, a pincer, essentially.
Going around back.
Yeah. Well, Uhud is very interesting, because Uhud, as the movie portrays, is exactly the same as it's understood in Islamic lore, which is that, A, it was a defeat ordained by God to teach the Muslims humility after the victory at Badr, to show the Muslims that victory is only possible through God. B, it shows the strategic or tactical failure, rather, when the Muslim archers abandon their positions to go loot the camp, not realizing that it was a feigned retreat by Khalid to like get them out of the mountain to hit them from the back. And C, to show how close Muhammad was to dying, because he gets isolated up on the mountain. And there was a real question of whether the Meccans would go up the mountain and kill him, but they don't.
Yeah, there's a moment of panic, right? Where they're like, yeah. Where is he? Oh my God.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, and they don't show it in the movie because of obvious reasons, but in the lore, he's only saved by Ali, who's considered one of the finest fighters on the Muslim side, who becomes essentially his bodyguard, cuts a swathe to the mountain to get him out of the battlefield when the tides turn. Khalid is portrayed in this movie as very interesting. Also, I just want to point out one second, the movie skipped a big part of Islamic, early Islamic history. There, after the defeat in Uhud, the movie shows that they make a truce right after. This is not true. They skip entirely the siege of Mecca, the siege of Medina, where the Meccans assemble an army and besiege Medina for 6 months, I believe. And during that siege, the Muslims in Medina are surrounded. There's like duels and fights like happening. But the way the Muslims survive that siege is by digging a trench around Medina to prevent the Meccans from charging in with their cavalry, because the Meccans' strength was cavalry. They had a lot more horses. So they dig a trench, which is why in Islamic lore that the siege of Medina is called the Battle of the Trench.
Yes. Yeah, every time I looked it up, I would get the trench instead. And it's like, well, what is this trench? It's a trench dug around Medina
to prevent the Meccans from coming in. And it was a 6-month siege. It's seminal Islamic lore because it's how the Muslims survived what could have been like the final death knell. The movie skips that entirely. I could see why, because it's already long enough as is. But then after the siege, which fails on the Meccan side, they do a truce that lasts for 10 years. They also skip through that 10 years very fucking quickly. The truce is for 10 years, and it's violated on the 8th year of the truce, where something happens. It's very unclear who violates it and how. In Islamic lore, obviously, we blame the Meccans, the perfidious Meccans. But it's clear that something happened. The truce is violated. And Muhammad, realizing that he now has the upper hand and a lot more allies, assembles an army and takes over Mecca. And that's when you see the final scene in the movie, where they all go in and you know, they're all wearing white, obviously, to show that they're all humble and austere, and they don't wear, you know, flashy colors like those Zoomers these days.
And they cast out all those damn idols out of the...
Yes.
That scene is so cool.
And we all
so
cheer.
Cool. Yeah. So, yeah, but then they skip a lot there. But in terms of the Khalid is also portrayed, again, because he's very important in Islamic history and a lot of people revere him, he's portrayed as a lot less, I don't want to say conflicted because that's even too nice. He was an awful human being in terms of an actual human being. He was lecherous. He was a drinker. He was a gambler. Even after he converted to Islam, or after the death of Muhammad, there's a thing called the Ridda Wars, which are the wars of apostasy, where a bunch of people who converted thought that because Muhammad was dead, they could renege on their deal. And the Muslims assemble an army to essentially crush rebellions across Arabia, like go from tribe to tribe crushing rebellions. And in one instance, Khalid likes the wife of a person he sees, and he was given explicit instructions that if these people ask for forgiveness and come back into the fold, you're supposed to like accept them back without fight. But because he likes this guy's wife, the guy tries to like ask for forgiveness, but he launches an attack, kills the guy, and takes his wife. He's a very he loves women, he loves drinking, and the movie doesn't show it obviously because it's supposed to show Khalid as this the sword of God. It's called the sword of God in Islamic history, but he's a military genius, and his people, like his soldiers, fight for him to the death, which is very, very important when you've got like tribal warfare happening.
Yeah, he's sick. Here's a subtextual thing. I'm just going to ask it. Am I detecting a subtle dig at the Sauds in the representation of the Meccans? The Amar line, "You cannot buy and sell God," really sticks out to me, like given the relationship between maybe a guy like Mustafa Qad or Gaddafi, the financier, and like the Sauds.
Which is funny because Gaddafi himself was also trying to buy and sell God with his pan-Islamic was bribing and stuff. I mean, it was because Gaddafi ends up financing and producing this. It was an attempt to like assert, the brother colonel against the Gulf states and like that axis of Gulf allies to the U.S. to like reinforce his anti-imperialist credentials, but like. Again, that line was so funny to me because Muhammad himself was a merchant. All else aside, the Quran, when Islam really started expanding after the initial wave of expansion of conquest, the reason Muslims in like Indonesia or fucking Mozambique converted wasn't so much by the sword. It was because Islam was essentially a conglomerate. And if you convert, you're in. You're a fucking shareholder in this fucking company. And you convert and you have mercantile connections in every port from South Africa to the fucking Indochina, right? Like, other Muslims will do deals with you. And the Quran, as coming from Muhammad, who's a merchant, has a lot of rules on things like, trade and mercantile activity in a way that it universalizes these rules. So you know what to expect from other Muslims.
It can't be understated how, and especially as Islam expands right into Persia basically and to the Byzantine Levant, how important the geographic location is right in the ancient world along the trade routes between Europe basically, Europe, North Africa, and the East, right? India and China, right? They are in the prime location. And whether by divine providence or by, that's just kind of how it shakes out, Muhammad, this guy who comes along and unites this middle ground between these vastly disparate and rich and trading geographies of the world, happens to be a merchant. The guy that ends up uniting all this stuff is a guy that gets the rules of the mercantile exchange, upon which, by the way, their future success is built.
Yeah, exactly. Which is why, it's so funny to me because modern Muslims will always, pretend that the Platonic ideal of a Muslim is a Bedouin. Like a guy on his horse
who lives in the desert.
Yeah. No, the Platonic ideal is the guy who makes deals. The guy who's in a fucking port making deals. That's the Platonic ideal of Islam.
And respects everybody and prays.
There you go.
Pork and doesn't drink, but a good businessman.
That is why Trump is going to convert to Islam. He made big deals, everybody.
No, it's perfect.
Yeah. He says usury is forbidden. He says
you can't do it.
He says Don Jr. gets two thirds. Ivanka gets one third. Don Jr. two thirds. Ivanka one third.
I told all my lenders, I said, this is illegal. It's haram. I'm not going to pay it. I'm not going to pay it, folks.
Yeah, no, it's again, it reminds the way Muslims see Bedouins reminds me a lot of how Brits, after having crushed the Scottish Highlanders, view the Scottish Highlanders as the Platonic ideal of like the warrior aristocracy. The same thing with the Muslims, like No, the real warrior core for Islam during its early expansion were merchants who were good warriors because they had to protect their fucking caravans going from raiders, but were also knew how to make deals and when to fight and when to not fight as much as importantly as when to fight. Whereas Muslims now are like, oh no, the Bedouin in the desert with his camel, that's what real Islam is. Like, no, it's not. Shut up. Go away. Which by the way, goes to your point about the Sauds, you know, the Platonic ideal being like the reason a lot of Muslims think the Platonic ideal are desert-dwelling tribesmen is because the Sauds were desert-dwelling tribesmen. Whereas this movie, you know, You Can't Buy or Sell God, is meant to be an indictment of both the Sauds as being tribesmen who became merchants, but also does a bait and switch where it avoids the real, merchants are the best, you know.
I mean, wait until we get to Lion of the Desert, and I think the incredibly accurate portrayal of Europeans who defeat and oppress somebody and then somehow hold them up as this, you know, emblematic figure of warrior princes, you know, or some shit.
Yeah. The scene at the end when Omar al-Mukhtar sits down with General Graziani, it reminds me a lot of when Abu Sufyan meets Muhammad. It's the exact, Akkad does the exact same thing in both movies, where the main villain is both evil for opposing the good people, but recognizes, and by the end recognizes, that the good people were good and divinely chosen. Like in Lion of the Desert, when he's like tearing up when he sees Omar get hanged, like he's like looking at him and he's like sort of like there's mist in his eyes. It's like a classic sort of like, he was an honorable enemy and he might have been right, you know, we don't know.
I just had like a Sartori moment. A connection was made. Growing up, the Halloween movies were my favorite horror film. Me and my brothers would all watch them. Michael Myers was a silent character in the film, and scenes were often shot from his POV. And people would talk to him, and like the camera would move with his face. And I wonder if Akkad was on set and talked to Wes Craven and was just like, hey, I got this already.
Akkad, you genius! Akkad, get this in!
Out. Yo, check this out.
Yeah.
No, John Carpenter, Connor, not Wes Craven. One more. I'm such an idiot. It's John Carpenter, not Wes Craven. I'm so fucking stupid.
That's fine.
No, leave it in.
You can dub over it. Yeah. You know, they always John Carpenter.
I had one last thing on the message. Al-Rasala. So the ending montage. I thought that this was the most powerful piece of the propaganda for me personally, is, you know, you are seeing the story of, I don't want to say ancient Islam. I think, you know, once we're in AD, is that still antiquity?
Yeah, you can treat it.
Yeah, ancient Islam. And we immediately cut to montages of modern contemporary Islam. We see the very first mosque being built in the movie. And then it cuts to, these are what modern mosques look like. They're beautiful architecture. They're beautiful building. And then you see all these contemporary Muslims praying together. And it is these shots to give you the sense of like, this is the legacy of Islam. This is why Islam is the fastest growing religion in the world, because of what you just watched. And this is what it looks like right now. And not to bring it all back to Anthony Quinn, but the Muslims that are in this montage look more like me and Alec. Like, they're not particularly dark skinned. And I think that to appeal to, you know, Hollywood and Western audiences. But it really, like, I ended the movie, I was like, wow, that was powerful. That gave me the sense that Islam.
How close were you to converting, Connor? Just tell us, how close were you to saying the Shahada?
Like I said, the next day I was like, hey, I need to go to Barnes & Noble and see if they got the Quran. Like, do they have a Quran for dummies so I can like get all this inside scoop? But it did give me, like, I'm reading Ghost Wars by Steve Cole, and it's talking about, you know, Afghanistan is absolutely not united after the Soviets pulled out. But it did, this movie made me think, despite the fact that I'm reading a book on it right now, wow, Islam is completely united. this is like one religion where there's no disagreements. Everybody gets along and they all pray
yeah,
together.
Not true.
That ending was the worst for me. It was the best and worst part. It was the best because it does give you, like, you see it while you're seeing it, you get this sort of heavy, big sort of goosebumps, fucking chills. Yes. Like, you see, like, I mean, I think Akkad does it on purpose. He'll show you like a black guy, an Asian guy, a white guy. They're all like praying, doing Hajj together. He's doing EDI in Hajj, essentially. but like, and I get why he does it, but it's also like, it's the opposite, exactly the opposite of what you're saying, Connor, where like, Islam splintered as soon as the Prophet died. The question of succession, because of, and one of the biggest, you know, forget, oh, would Hitler have won if he took Stalingrad or whatever, fucking dumb World War II counterfactuals. The big counterfactual I always throw at people, what would have happened if Muhammad had a son? He had a son who died in infancy, Ibrahim. What would have happened if he had a son that grew into adulthood? Would Islam become a monarchical thing? Would it have become an hereditary position? Those questions became so open once he died, there was no son, and it just splintered immediately. Ali versus Abu Bakr, and then you had Abu Ubaidah, you had Zayd, you had all of these different characters vying for control. And to your point about the unity and no disagreements, Connor, like, Akkad does a scene where he shows everyone doing Hajj, and Hajj is perhaps the only time Muslims will unite because every Muslim has to do Hajj, everyone knows that. But like, I'm watching Hajj, and all I can think of are Shia Muslims who do similar pilgrimages for Karbala, for Ashura, that Sunnis don't do, but Shia do. But they get similar numbers. They get like 5 million people go up to Karbala every year to do Ashura.
I mean, it struck me, we really just don't have anything like that in the Christian world. There's nothing that.
People don't go to the Vatican anymore to pray or anything, do they? Like, there's no, like, a center of, like that pulls... I guess you guys don't have pilgrimages as like a rule, though. Like, you don't have, it's not a demand for every good Christian has to do a pilgrimage somewhere.
Catholics will go to, I mean, pilgrimages used to be a way, way bigger thing in basically medieval times when, you know, a month long, basically drunken trip, right, to go pray at a cathedral and then the trip back, right? But it was basically fun all the way there and all the way back.
I mean, think about it, the modern version of that is British lads on tour in Marbella. that's a classic modern pilgrimage. It's like three British guys who are nicknamed Baz, Shagger, and Ginge who go to Marbella.
I went to Israel for a study abroad thing in college, and there were some alumni of my university that tagged along, and they were much older, and they made a point of it to, like, we want to visit. And, you know, it's a tourism industry. We want to visit all these holy sites surrounding, you know, Jesus and look at all these. They had like kind of a map plan. And I think that's the closest. There's no like real religious pilgrimage. It is all tourism pilgrimage.
Yeah, Catholics will go to the Vatican. I mean, Americans broadly will go to Rome and look around. And if they're Catholic, they might go to the Vatican, or if they're interested, they might go to the Vatican. But there's no
Christians go to Bethlehem or any parts of the West Bank where it's important to Christianity.
Certain ones do, but there's no prescription to do so. And by the way, doing so is getting a lot more difficult as time goes on. It's not getting easier, ironically.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure the Israelis don't like Christians as much as they don't like other people. Well, but here's the thing, because like you said, there's no prescription. And I assume there's just so many different sites, like there's only one Mecca, right? Like there's only one Kaaba that you go to. I mean, obviously the Holy Mosque in Jerusalem, and Masjid al-Aqsa is also very important in Islam. And, you know, Karbala for the Shia, but like, Hajj is only in Mecca. Every Muslim has to go to Hajj. You know, if you can afford it, and if you're healthy, you have to go at one point in your life. So it funnels all Muslim. And to your point, Connor, about like unity, like this movie was filmed in like 74, 75. So the scenes, the modern scenes of the Muslims doing the pilgrimage in Hajj, you have like several hundred thousand. We've like this Hajj just finished last week. Last week was this year's Hajj season, the pilgrimage season. I think it was 5.5 million. Arrived there, you know, and obviously, like, there's been a lot of news. I don't know if you guys have read the news about this. Some 400 people have died from heat waves.
It's up to about 1,000 right now.
Yeah, the New York Times said 400. I was like, it's a massive undercount. We're well over 1,000 now. My dad went this year. It's his first time.
Oh, congrats.
It took him a long time. He's a bit old, but I'm glad that he went. Everyone I've talked to who's went, my parents, my uncles, my aunts, I've never gone, will say, to your point, Connor, when you're doing Hajj, when you're all wearing the same white robes because you have to wear the mahram, and you're surrounded by like Egyptians, Sudanese, Indonesians, fucking Indians, Ghanaians, everyone from around the world, you all feel equal. It does have this sort of a feeling of genuine religious ecstasy, religious psychosis. But like psychosis, not in a derogatory sense, just in a sense where like your consciousness sort of wobbles a bit and you feel like a cell in part of a bigger body, you know? That ending scene is probably the greatest piece of religious propaganda in a modern movie I've ever seen.
I have to say, the message delivers on that. The feeling that you get of a kind of glorious radical equality of Islam really does come across. You know, like Connor says, it really makes you interested in the religion, and whether that bears out to the day-to-day realities of is another matter. Yeah, ecstasy. I mean, a glorious moment in the end, the founding of this thing that has abolished an unequal and unjust old order, the uniting of a people around a common cause and an idea of kind of equality and shared destiny before God, right? It's great.
Yeah.
And the and like Connor said, right, like the continuum of taking this old story and showing you exactly what it's led to of a kind of multicultural celebration around the modern day Kaaba in Mecca, right? It still exists. It's still happening now. Join up. Call your local imam.
When I was in college, I did try to, you know, I was exploring all these different religions and wondering if Episcopalianism was really for me.
Is it for anyone, really?
It's for the laziest Christians. It works out. And I did go to a mosque with my friend who, you know, was born and raised Muslim. And I did the wudu. I went into the prayer room. I don't know what you call it, but I stood up, stood down, you know, shook my head back and forth. I did everything.
Awesome. Yes, you're one of us. Now, if you do it once, you're one of us. You can't take that back.
Okay. Well, what was funny is I was blown away by the interior architecture. Like, oh, this is really beautiful. Like, there is a sense of brotherhood. And then the imam that day was a very young guy, probably my age, maybe like 22. And he gave apparently a very conservative sermon about, like, if you are not actively trying to convert everyone around your life into Islam, like, what are you doing? You are a bad Muslim. And when we left, my friend was like, you shouldn't listen to that guy. He's a bad representation of what we're doing.
The radicalism of youth. It is something. Yeah.
So Amr, one of the messages in this that really speaks to me as, you know, a non-Catholic, but Christian adjacent. Akkad makes the point that Muslims and Christians have a shared history that Muslims respect and like Christians as their brothers, that, you know, the differences between us are as thin as this line in the sand.
Yeah, yes, one of the greatest lines. Awesome, awesome. I love that scene. That scene was so awesome because, I want to this.
Go off, King. I mean, it's very affecting when it happens. You just want them to hug and embrace.
Yeah. I wanted them to fist bump. I wanted them to do like the classic like fist bump. Be like, awesome, let's go.
Fuck the representative from Mecca. We hate him.
Yes. Yeah, that was Amr ibn As, by the way. That's Amr ibn As, who also later converts and becomes the governor of Egypt. He plays a really important role in the post-Islamic civil war. I wanted to say first, the other thing this movie strenuously avoids, which I thought was hilarious, is that there will be scenes where it'll be like, Muhammad says that Christians and Jews are equal to Muslims. It's true, he said that. But it avoids the expulsion of the three Jewish tribes who lived in Medina at various points during Islam's progress. And the reason he expels them is because another thing that this movie avoids, because the same way when it really skipped past the uniting of the tribes to make one tribe, is that Muhammad's legitimacy, the reason Muhammad advertises himself as a prophet, is through the Abrahamic lineage. He calls himself explicitly the seal of the prophets, the end of the line from Abraham through Isaac, Ishmael, Jonah, Jacob, Moses, Jesus, and now him, and that's the end. In order to achieve that, he needs legitimacy from the Jewish tribes of Arabia, because they're the keepers of the Abrahamic faith in Arabia. There's not a lot of Christians in Arabia. They're mostly in Abyssinia. And in order to achieve that legitimacy, he needs them to accept Islam and accept him as their prophet, and they don't because reasons, political reasons. But he advertises him as a messiah, and he's rejected as a messiah by the tribes in Medina, which creates this conflict. Now, he doesn't expel them all at once. He expels them. There's different casus belli for each tribe. One tribe, the Beni Nadir, there's an argument in a marketplace where allegedly a Jewish merchant assaults a Muslim woman. A Muslim man kills him. And it creates this blood feud, and then he assembles a force and expels that tribe. Another tribe tried to make a deal with the Meccans during the siege of Medina to attack the Muslims from within, Muhammad gets the word of it from the big guy upstairs because, you know, he has God on his side and expels them before they can make a move. And then the third side, there's an attempted assassination attempt on Muhammad early on. It's very, again, it's very unclear, and it all comes through Islamic lore, which is clearly biased. But the underlying thing is, in order to make the Muslims a nation, a legitimate nation under one prophet, he needs to either get the Jewish tribes to accept his legitimacy as Messiah or expel them. Now, to go back to the movie avoids that entirely. There's no touching of that. To go back to your point about Abyssinia, what I found interesting is, unlike the Jewish question, which he avoids entirely, the Christian question for Akkad, he's like, oh, we're all brothers. And they agree we're brothers, which is what I wanted to ask you. Like, that scene when the Meccan envoy is like sort of doing a fucking rap battle with the Muslim guy. And they do like, the Meccan envoy is like, they say Mary is a whore. They say she fucking whatever. And they're like, no, we say in the Quran. And they do the verses from the chapter of Mary in the Quran, which I know well, one of my favorite chapters in Arabic because of the poetry. The meter is really good, the fucking word choices and stuff. But one thing he says is like, God tells me in the Quran, God tells Mary, you're going to have a son. She's like, how can I have a son when no man has touched me? He says it's an ordained thing and we send him to you as a mercy unto mankind. I feel like in the movie, they gloss over the big question, which is Jesus God? You know, God said that Jesus will come and Jesus came, and the king, the Christian king is like, the difference between you and I is like smaller than this line. He draws a line in the sand. And I'm like, man, that guy should be pissed off. They're not recognizing him as God.
I mean, the question is always, right, like, is it enough? And I mean, in the scene, right, in the narrative of the film, indicating to you that the Meccan is a fucking snake and is trying to get these people thrown out on a false pretense and then getting owned in front of
by facts and logic, by debate. It was debate club, essentially.
Scene was so funny because when they asked, like, straight up, is Jesus the coming of God? And they're like, well, we're not saying no.
Can I recite something real quick?
I was because, like, okay, I don't know enough about Christianity. I think the Abyssinians were monophysites. I'm not sure. But like, The extras behind the king should be like hooting and hollering that these people aren't recognizing that either he is God or he is, like, you know, both God and man. Like, whatever it is, but you didn't answer the question. You just said that the Quran said that God sent Jesus, which is true in an Islamic sense, but like, the Christians should be pissed off.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those, right? I think we've talked about this, Amr, how there's always more, there's more animosity between people of the same sect over small differences than there is between different sects about their similarities.
Yes. Right?
When you commune with someone else and you say, well, so you pray at church and you're a monotheist, but these people can agree that they're mostly the same. Get two people of maybe even the same Catholic background and ask them about the nature of God or communion or whether the wine, you know, between Episcopalians and Catholics, for instance, right? Is the wine actually the Jesus's blood, or is it
historically a
metaphor that we share together, right? There's wars fought over this, right? They get excommunicated over this.
Yeah, I've argued about Christianity with more Christians than I have with anyone who's like not Christian.
I think a lot of Americans don't remember, for instance, right, one of the most celebrated, you know, English speaking Christian schisms historically, especially in the past century, right, has been the Irish versus the North Irish or the British. Remember that when they say Catholic or Protestant, they don't mean American evangelical. They mean Anglican and Catholic, which, speaking as a Catholic, are virtually the same, right? I mean, they are so close.
All right, pal.
Yeah.
Yeah, you drink the actual blood of Jesus, you fucking
say. We're not talking about like a Mormon and like an Egyptian Copt, right? Who are like, I mean, the Copt might as well be a Muslim, right? Probably a Mormon. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, when you're talking about this, Alec and Connor's reaction, all I can think of is that scene when in Kingdom of Heaven, when they're like arguing, heresy! And they're like always like, heresy! Heresy! anyways, Kingdom of Heaven is another episode altogether, but to your point about like Christians will argue with other Christians instead of Muslims, historically, I think so. I don't know which council it was. I believe it was Nicaea. I could be wrong. It could be Nicaea, Nicaea or Nicaea. Sorry. When Islam was spreading in Arabia. No, this doesn't include Abyssinia. Because Abyssinia was its own thing. Christianity wise, like they had their own church. But one of the reasons Christians in Egypt and Syria supported the Muslims over the Romans because the Council of Nicaea had basically branded the practices of Christians in Egypt and Syria at the time, who were monophysites, as heretics. So when the Muslims came, they're like, we don't care about your goddamn doctrinal differences. As long as you pay the goddamn tax, you can say or do whatever the fuck you want. And they're like, oh, we like these guys. Whereas the Romans were actually persecuting them. And there was suppression of their belief.
Romans are big on rules. They always have been. They always will be. I mean, a lot of it involved. We're talking about Islam. We're not talking about Christianity this episode. But a lot of it surrounded what is Easter about? And what do we get to celebrate? And what don't we get to celebrate? Which is basically some people seeing them having one kind of parade in the street for Easter and being like, I don't like that. I don't like how they're worshiping the death of the death and resurrection of Christ. Right. Like, please make a rule so that they can't do that kind of parade, essentially. Yeah. The Abyssinian scene is so good just in the English version with Earl Cameron as Al-Najashi. And he looks like somebody out of Tolkien, white, wispy kind of billowing beard and striking blue eyes. He really does look like an ancient king, of myth.
Yeah, he looks very hobbit-like. He has a very hobbit-like element to him. Yeah. It's so cool.
By the way, the Arabic actor is very short. So when I saw the same scene over, I showed my wife the scene with the translator. By the way, the language was differing a little bit. But when he walks up to the Muslims, he's like 30 centimeters shorter than them or something. And Earl Cameron's like a big, stately, enormous, tall thing, very funny.
Okay, so that takes care of our conversation on the message. We're going to wrap up this episode, and then we'll be back next week with a follow-up of this discussion discussing the other Akkad film, Lion of the Desert. Amr, thank you for joining us this week, and I can't wait to continue this conversation about, what did you call him, the brother general?
The brother colonel.
Brother colonel. Yeah. Brother colonel Gaddafi.
A week for you guys, a 10-minute break for us.
Yeah. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam.
And Merry Christmas. Okay. All right.
You're being beheaded for that one.
I'm going to run to the bathroom real quick.